We knew the economy was going to turn at some point, but you never really can be prepared for timing or speed of change.
I hope this cycle we're in doesn't take us back to the days of regulatory purgatory, where everything we did had consequences.
As the world continues to change, we have found out we need to be even more nimble as we move forward.
By requiring things like business continuity planning and pandemic plans, we need to think proactively about what we need to do in the future.
We better grab our helmets and start getting prepared today.
Banking is a risk business, but in today's environment, we are being faced with uncertain times. Financial institutions have always had partners who could help evaluate, address, and mitigate risk. But today, they need to lean on those partners more than ever. Welcome to Bank on Whitfleet. Each episode will feature discussions around industry issues, hot topics, and current trends, giving you an insider's look at how top performers and professionals are staying ahead of the curve. All right, let's get into today's conversation.
Welcome to another episode of Bank on Whitfleet. My name is Mike Vessel, and I'm a partner in the financial services practice of Whitfleet, and will be your host. Today's podcast will provide our listeners with an overview of the merger and acquisition, or M&A, area. Since you can't discuss M&A without talking about the value of an organization, we'll also talk a little bit about valuations. We all know that M&A was hot in our industry until the pandemic hit. There's a feeling that once the economy turns positive again, the M&A area is going to pick up. And while the last three podcasts that we've done have focused on areas that management and the board of directors of institutions should be knowledgeable about, this podcast won't necessarily have the same perspective. However, we will address certain things that boards and management should be aware of related to M&A on both the buy and sell side, as well as share some information about board and management involvement in the valuation process. As we all know, having knowledge about this topic will help you address issues or questions that could come up from your management team, other board members, shareholders, and so on, even regulators. I also need to qualify our discussion before we move forward to let everybody know that if you or your institution are involved in M&A discussions, it's important to get an attorney involved early on in the process, as they, and not us, will be providing legal advice. I'm pleased to have Kevin Yonke with us on today's podcast. Kevin's a partner at Whitfleet who leads our valuation, forensic, and litigation services area. Kevin's been at the firm a long time, over 30 years, has performed thousands of valuations and appraisals for all sorts of business, but with a focus in the financial services area. Kevin's also a leader in Whitfleet Corporate Finance, which is our investment banking arm, which helps institutions who want to buy or sell. Kevin has several certifications, and he actually has a pretty good sense of humor for a transaction type guy. So welcome, Kevin.
Thanks, Mike.
Kevin, just kind of hopping into it, as I noted above or earlier here, the M&A market was pretty hot over the last couple of years prior to the pandemic, and really kind of since the Great Recession. But the perception is it's slowed down a bit. Can you give us a picture of what you're seeing today related to M&A?
I sure can here, Mike. To your point, things certainly have slowed down. By way of comparison, between 2012 and 2019, the number of transactions averaged approximately 250 annually. Now, fast forward to the first half of 2020, 50 transactions. So if we extrapolate, that means 100 will transact here in 2020. We haven't been at this level since, approximately in 2008 and 2009 at the bottom of the Great Recession. So there are some transactions still going to market, and there are some still getting done, but the pace has slowed dramatically, and many deals are getting postponed, renegotiated, and quite frankly, there are a number that are being terminated.
So I know you've got a crystal ball sitting on your desk, Kevin. What does your crystal ball say about the future of M&A in the financial services and financial institutions world?
Mike, if you or I had that crystal ball, I think we'd be on a beach as opposed to having this podcast, but deals are going to occur. And at some point, they're going to pick up. The reasons are still there. The cost of regulation, the cost of technology, number of shareholders that went through de novo years ago that are now looking for liquidity. It will pick up again, but it remains to be seen when that's going to be. Going back to that crystal ball, if you can tell me how severe or how long this pandemic will last, I can tell you when things will pick up, but they will pick up again. It's just we're in a period of a whole lot of uncertainty.
Good. So if we think about the fact that M&A has slowed down and it will pick up at some point in time, what are your thoughts about how we look at M&A today? Should we disregard it until it gets hot again? Should we keep it on the forefront? especially if that's part of our strategy, what do you think we should be doing or thinking about in regards to M&A overall?
I don't think you put your head in the sand right now. I think you continue to work your strategic plan and then the M&A piece of it. You can continue to look at targets. Just know that there is some uncertainty out there. Going back to my earlier comment, you know, the severity as well as the tenure of this pandemic. But there is uncertainty out there. But I think you consider your strategic plan. You consider the M&A piece of it. It's just that it's going to depend. What you'll hear from me during this podcast, probably a handful of different times, is it depends on facts and circumstances. So if you're an institution considering selling, there is a reason for some to continue down that process. And in other cases, there is a real reason for you to hold off until market metrics improve.
So we all know that you can't separate M&A from the valuation part of the equation. Valuation obviously drives M&A to a large degree. I think there's a lot of factors that are involved in that, but valuation is certainly an important one. We've seen over the last few months, stock indexes down 35% as COVID kind of became a major issue. How do you think COVID is impacting valuations today, Kevin?
I think given the fact that there's uncertainty and given the fact that risk has come up, there is a discount in valuations today. The question is how much? Many of our financial institution clients, they aren't affected as much as what some of the stock indices that you're talking about. The real hard thing is for banks that have asked us to revalue them now, say as of March 31st or as of June 30th, is we're now in that COVID period. And as a result, things are changing. The question is what does a projection look like today? If we ask management to put together a projection, do we come out of the pandemic in 20? Is it 21? Is it 22? We just don't know. You know, we have a couple things that are affecting banks. We have a lot of our clients that there is a lot of fee income from the PPP loans, but there's also stress as it relates to the portfolio. And quite frankly, there are a number of our clients that are kind of meshing the two together. And what I mean by that is the additional PPP income that they're picking up, they're then taking this amount and sticking it into their ALLL provision. Now, is one going to be more than the other over a period of time? That remains to be seen, but it's one way to kind of have one kind of take the form of the other. For banks we have sold and banks that are looking to buy, the pricing for the most part still remains strong, but there is a lot of uncertainty going on.
Boy, that was a lot of triples in there. I've not heard that many triples in one sentence for a long time. But, you know, I think the concept that you're talking about, Kevin, is really normalized earnings, right? Maybe you just want to take a second and explain about, you know, valuations are somewhat based on normalized earnings, right?
Sure. When we go through the valuation process, we try to get rid of anything that is non-recurring or non-operating. Now, the non-recurring is something that we're talking about. You know, we've got maybe a large increase to the ALLL. You and I were both baseball players. Mike, we can talk about triples, I think. So you have that going on. So we're going to try to get rid of anything that's non-recurring. Now, if something seems to occur in multiple years, so if we go back to the Great Recession, if we're going to normalize for a non-recurring ALLL, and oh, by the way, it's happened for the last 4 years, well, at that point, it's become recurring. But notwithstanding that, what we try to do is get rid of anything non-recurring. The other thing is we try to adjust for anything non-operating. We see it more in, say, a family-owned bank, whereby maybe there are tax motivations. Maybe there is someone on the payroll that, from an operating standpoint, doesn't need to be. But when we try to adjust earnings, we try to get rid of anything non-recurring and non-operating.
Great. Thank you for that clarification, Kevin. You know, over the course of the pandemic, as you said, there have been several deals that have either been put on hold and some that are even terminated. Those valuations have probably bounced back a little bit, but there's still a lot of unknowns. So with the fact that there's unknowns out there because of COVID, because of the current and potential future impacts of the economy, should banks consider having their valuation redone today? A lot of valuations, I know your group does at the end of the year. It's a little unusual perhaps to have them done mid-year or something, but is that something that should be done? And maybe expand on what sort of circumstances an institution should consider when they are looking as to whether their valuation should be re-upped, if you will?
I would probably consider two drivers on why you might want to have a new valuation done or a prior one. One is maybe from a timing standpoint. If you haven't had one done in a while, maybe one should be done in that case. The second thing is if there's going to be some sort of a transaction or a material transaction. We're looking to buy back the shares of one of our shareholders who has passed away, and we're looking to buy the shares from that estate. We're looking to go through a large buyback plan. And there are cases why we have bank clients that aren't going down that path right now. But I would look at, from a timing standpoint, it might make sense to update your valuation, or if there's going to be some sort of material transaction.
And by material transaction, a lot of banks use that annual valuation for stock transactions amongst their shareholders. Maybe not that the bank or holding company is buying those shares directly, but they let the shareholders know what that valuation is. So is that what you'd consider a major transaction, or should they consider that if they know that there's a lot of transactions rather than maybe a major transaction involved?
I think that's fair. I mean, you know, whether we're talking about material or we're talking about a high level of frequency, I would say yes, Mike.
Okay, great. I know you just mentioned as well the fact that there are formal stock buyback programs. With valuations somewhat being down now, is now the time for an institution to consider having a buyback?
Well, I touched upon it a little while ago, is in that we have some clients that, given the uncertainty, so let's say that we valued them as of 12/31/19, and now we're issuing a report some 90 days later, and the COVID pandemic has started. And the question I got a number of times was, is the value that you came up with as of 12/31/19 still a good number? And I'd have to think on how I answered that the first time. And I said, you know what, when I valued the bank or the holding company as of 12/31/19, it made sense then. Because in the valuation world, we put together analysis on what is known or knowable. And as of 12/31/19, you know, we didn't know, or the pandemic was not knowable. So come 3/31, a number of our bank clients have elected not to go through any sort of buyback. They had a policy, they'd set the price for the next year. This is our price this year. We have a number of clients that have said, you know what, we just don't know how long and how severe. Kind of like my facts and circumstances. There are two phrases you'll hear a bit here. As a result, they're not doing anything. But notwithstanding that, I think you should always have some sort of a plan. Right now is an opportunity to purchase at a lower price than, say, what it would have been last year. But the question becomes, is the price as of 12/31/20 going to be lower, or is it going to be higher? We just have a lot of uncertainty going on right now.
I would think, too, that whether you do a buyback program now or later is somewhat contingent as well on your capital and your strategic plan and so on. Is that a fair assessment?
Agreed. I mean, you know, they say cash is king. You could say capital's king, too. What's capital going to look like? I mean, you know, I'd made the comment of swapping PPP loan fee income for an amount going into ALLL. So we are seeing that. Maybe that's a good mechanism. Maybe it's light. Maybe it's strong. But, you know, as you're looking at capital, what's our ALLL going to look like? You know, what kind of fee income is our dividend policy going to change between now and, say, the end of the year or the pandemic? There's lots of things, but, you know, capital is certainly top of mind, or it should be.
So we also talked a little bit about valuations going down, Kevin, and I know you've had to explain this to some banks before, and I guess this might be an opportunity for you to share some of that. But how does a board, how does a CEO, when they get a lower valuation, how do they explain that to the users of the valuation?
Obviously, we want to be honest, but, you know, the comment I would make is, I think compared to, say, 20 or 30 years ago, I think that boards are more educated. I think shareholders are more educated. There's a lot more information out there today than there was in the past. And as a result, I think it's a matter of explaining the whys. Maybe you have some analysis done either internally by management or externally by, you know, investment banking or an accounting firm. But I think that if you provide them being your board or shareholders with the information, they will understand what's going on from an economy, from a pandemic standpoint, and things like that. It's really a matter of quantifying.
So I have one more question on the stock buybacks. We've had some organizations that have done either formal or informal buybacks without a current valuation. Talk about the risk of not having a valuation if you're doing some sort of a buyback, or perhaps even just sharing an overall value that's dated.
It reminds me of a story, Mike. Back in 2008, and even before then, there was an institution that we would value every year, and they would use our conclusion as the price that they would buy back shares for. So 2008, Great Recession is starting here, if you will. And before we're about to start our work, the bank president asked me, do you think our stock value is going to be going down? I said, unfortunately, I do, between what is happening internal to the bank, as well as what is happening external out in the market, out in the economy, and everything else like that. And he said, okay, I get that, but I don't want you to value the bank. We're going to use the same multiple that we used last year. So if we came up with some multiple of 8% capital, they were going to apply that to their capital 1 year later. I said, I don't know if that's a great idea. And he said, well, why not? I said, I think you're overpaying. And that might be great if you're one of the shareholders selling, but for all the shareholders remaining inside the bank or inside the holding company, I don't think it's fair to them. And if you're looking to be paying something fair because of the fiduciary responsibility, I think it needs to be fair for those staying as well as those that are leaving.
I think that's a great point. So knowing that valuations are down and we can't necessarily impact ourselves, all of the economic and other factors that go into the valuation, are there some things that an organization can do today to either increase their value or at least keep that value stable?
I think the drivers to value really haven't changed. If we think about this from a practical standpoint, when you have an acquirer buying a target bank, they pay what they pay for a number of reasons, but oftentimes you can bring that down to a few different, maybe major points. You know, the first is from a talent standpoint. When someone acquires another institution, more often than not, that acquirer is not sitting on a bench full of people that they can plug into that target, that bank that they've bought. So people, talent continues to be a driver to value. Core deposits, the stickier the better. Now, in certain rate environments, maybe they become worth a little bit less than in other rate environments, but people pay for core deposits. Clean portfolios, or if it's not clean, that it has been adequately reserved for. But keep in mind, if you're a seller, I'm going to spin the table here, if you will. If you are a seller, keep in mind that when that potential buyer is performing due diligence on your loan portfolio, more often than not, they're going to think that your ALLL is not adequate, or they're not going to think it is as strong as what you believe. So clean portfolio would be my third item. And then the last thing is non-interest income sources. We talked a bit about the PPP fee income, but keep in mind that is more of a non-recurring, but if you have recurring non-interest income sources, those would be the main drivers. And quite frankly, they really haven't changed.
Let's move back a little bit to the M&A side of the equation. So what should a board of directors know about M&A today, given the current environment?
That's a good question, Mike. I'd go back to maybe how we started, in that M&A is still going on. It's still happening, albeit at a much slower pace than what it was. Now, this can be a two-edged sword. If you're selling and your bank still looks very good, you know, we had talked about either the earnings or a clean portfolio, or perhaps one that's tainted but has adequately reserved for, those deals are still getting nice premiums because there isn't a lot of them. Think of supply and demand. And if you are, in fact, a buyer, be prepared to perform your diligence. Now, keep in mind that, you know, there might be more people in that bidding process because of the few number of deals. So think of it that way. I mean, the M&A market is still going on. I mean, it's like Ben Franklin says, you know, the only thing that are certain are death and taxes. That's still going on. So I would encourage you to continue looking at opportunities, but make sure you're doing your diligence from a buy side, and from a sell side, have an honest conversation with your advisors to say, you know what, is now a good time for us, or should we be waiting?
So kind of along those lines, Kevin, you know, there can often be conflict between what a board might want to see, what shareholders might want to see related to M&A versus what management might want to see. if you're an acquirer, management can get overwhelmed with an acquisition because it's in addition to their day job, for example. If you're selling, management can be conflicted, concerned about change. Can you discuss any steps or recommendations you might have related to both sides? And, you know, what should the board be considering perhaps related to the merger transaction, considering this possible internal conflict?
On behalf of some of our clients on a buy side, we've given some advice to some of our clients. If they're looking to acquire and they'd rather not get into an auction type of a process, that maybe they should be reaching out to those that interest them. It might be someone that is in a contiguous market. It might be someone that they participate back and forth. Maybe it's someone that they knew through graduate school banking, whatever. But in those cases, they might be reaching out to this potential target. Now, that potential target, you can look at it a couple of ways. Should they be talking to that target's president? Or should they be talking to maybe the chairperson of the board or someone from the board? And what I mean by that, and I'm certainly not trying to point a finger, but I have had it happen whereby that bank president, he or she is acting like a gatekeeper. No, our shareholders don't want to sell, so on and so forth. And really what that bank president is doing is they're really gatekeeping so that they keep their job. They may own some shares, they may not own some shares, but they're biased given that they're trying to not think about the shareholders, they're thinking about their own pocketbook. Doesn't happen all the time, but I do see it happen. So I think a board needs to be cognizant of that. And maybe the chairperson should be talking with the chairperson of that other organization, that potential target. So I would look at that from an acquirer standpoint. If I switch gears and think about from the selling standpoint, selling a bank takes time. And you touched upon it that management, you know, has a day job, if you will. And this is the reason that a lot of banks will hire investment bankers to help sell their organization. But, you know, keep in mind from a buy standpoint that there are also situations that, you know, do you want your president talking with someone? You know, the goals of the board and of the president and management need to be aligned, and any sort of biases need to be removed, I guess is what I would say.
So really what I'm hearing from you, Kevin, is that in order to minimize conflict, you know, the natural conflict that's going to exist on either side of the transaction, you really want to try and keep the circle small, at least initially, right?
I would say the circle small and the right people in the circle, Mike.
So I know we're not attorneys, so we can't necessarily address all the legal aspects of this. Can you talk about the steps an organization might want to take if they get an offer from somebody or if someone approaches them just to even have a conversation about a merger?
Sure. So, you know, we're going to assume that someone has approached us about buying or merging us in or something like that, basically unsolicited. And what you're talking about is a letter that is oftentimes referred to as a bear hug letter. Basically, it says, you know, we're interested in a merger of our two organizations. Here are all the positives. Or I might come out and say, you think that you should be thinking about your shareholders from a fiduciary responsibility. They'll drop that phrase in there oftentimes. And as a result, you know, we're willing to offer X dollars or a multiple of book or something like that. So the first thing that you should do if you receive something like this is speak with your attorney. And you had some opening comments, Mike. I mean, good attorneys in this space are worth their weight in gold as it relates to the advice and the hurdles that they can get you through. But first thing I would say is to contact your attorney. And then what that attorney and you will probably do is to reach out to someone to help perform some analysis. Basically, you know, okay, we've got this offer and they're willing to pay us X dollars. Let's have some analysis performed. Is the offer good? Is it not good? Are there other facts and circumstances? You have a fiduciary responsibility to consider this. Your attorney can respond and say, you know, we don't believe it's in the best interest of our shareholders or our community and our people. And as a result, thank you for your letter, but we have no interest. But there should be some basis, some analysis performed to be able to respond to that letter.
So one of the common questions I've gotten from clients over the last 5 or 6 years, and probably even longer than that, is what steps do I need to take to be an acquirer? In other words, if I want to be an acquirer, are there particular steps that I should be taking today, even maybe before I start to approach people or whatever, you know, to get my organization ready? Can you comment on that, Kevin?
There's probably two or three things that I would recommend. I think the first one would be is to get the word out that you're looking. I mean, it can be done informally by, you know, whether it's some of these meet to learns with these other banks, you know, tell them that you're interested in acquiring or merging in other firms. It could be getting the word out through the law firms that are in this space, the investment bankers that are in this space. So, you know, whether it's a one-on-one conversation or whether it's an auction process that you're considered. In conjunction with that, I would probably suggest that you surround yourself with your experts, your accounting firm, your lawyer, investment banking firms. You've got your team kind of ready to go should an opportunity come about. And then I would also go through some analysis so you know what you can afford. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you look at some modeling in terms of what does capital look like based upon a size of an acquisition, based upon some metrics within that. If we pay a certain dollar for this bank, and given that goodwill doesn't account for capital, what can we afford based upon pricing, based upon size? I think then you have to look probably inward and say, okay, does it make sense for us to look just say within a small radius, given what we have from a talent standpoint? And then lastly, along the same lines as, you know, technology, you know, given any sort of constraints, should we be making that radius smaller or larger? And that will dictate where we should be looking, or if we should be looking, or what size we should be looking, or what multiples we could be paying.
So Kevin, if we're an acquirer and we have a target in mind who's willing to listen, how do we go about determining price and maybe as important, the related structure of a potential deal?
Price can depend. I mean, oftentimes value is in the eye of the beholder. So, you know, you can get guidance from various advisors as to relates to what this bank is worth. Now, that bank might be worth more or less to you based upon a number of things, based upon, you know, we think that there's going to be some deposit runoff because our culture is different than theirs. It might be based upon putting them into our footprint. What does any sort of cost savings become for us? It might be different for somebody else, but what sort of cost savings we have? I mean, really what it comes down to is facts and circumstances. Many of our people are on some mailing lists where investment bankers say, well, this is the average and this is the median. But keep in mind, if you're grabbing the median out of some sort of publication, half of the deals are above that median and half of the deals are below. And you have to look at the facts and circumstances for that organization as well as that organization to you.
So likewise, if you're approached by someone who puts an offer on the table for you, are there some of the same criteria or different criteria that you'd utilize to determine whether the pricing is reasonable and fair and structure?
I think they're similar, but you bring up a good point, Mike, as it relates to structure. A long time ago, I heard someone say, I'll let anyone set the price if I can set the terms and the structure. The price that the bank or the holding company sells for might be the one that makes you kind of puff out your chest and say, we sold for a multiple of X or so many dollars. But over the years, you and I have been involved in transactions whereby the tax structure was not conducive. And as a result, the shareholders of that holding company bank didn't put as much money in their pocket as if they would have had they done a little bit of planning on the front end. You might be willing to accept a smaller price if the terms and if the structure are more tax efficient for you.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You're right. We've seen some of the deals that have been put on the table that have had a tax structure that results in double taxation, essentially, because we're selling assets rather than stock. And ultimately, the shareholders get less. So I think that's critical. And a lot of that is legal and accounting related. So your point earlier about bringing the experts in is really important. So when we look at a transaction and we're kind of in the process of one, obviously there's due diligence. So what should a board and management expect regarding due diligence and who should be responsible for that?
I'm going to take that question as if we're a seller to start, Mike. The first point that I'd like to bring up is that today, more than 90% of the time in due diligence is loan diligence. Think of it as loan review. And this was probably less than 50% before the Great Recession. So keep in mind, you know, where that focus might be today versus what it was pre-2008. What generally happens in diligence is that your team will have a meeting or a call or exchange of documents, And really what it is you're taking a list of potential due diligence items, you know, requests for information or tasks, and we're divvying it up. Now, we have certain clients that are very sophisticated that they feel very comfortable performing a lot of that diligence in-house. They have the staff, they have the expertise, but really it's a matter of divvying it up. So your accounting firm, your investment banker, your law firm, and you might be doing various pieces of it. I made the comment regarding attorneys earlier. You know, attorneys will get into termination fees on contracts, you know, what that looks like. They will look at employee benefit plans, you know, various contracts. Once again, they're worth their weight in gold by the diligence that they're performing, the agreements that they're drafting and reviewing, and things like that. You know, we have other clients that maybe are a little bit less sophisticated, so their advisors are performing more of the diligence is what they are. And we perform the loan review. We do that a lot as it relates to our clients on the acquiring side. And then I'm going to assume now if in fact, from a standpoint of if you are a seller, and, you know, so someone is performing diligence on your organization, if you're taking some sort of stock back from them, and let's say that they're thinly publicly traded or they are not publicly traded, you know, you're going to want to perform some diligence on them. So as you're getting shares back in exchange for yours, you have a comfort level that their ALLL is adequate and their loan portfolio is not stressed and things like that.
Kevin, before you mentioned the fact that you need to get your advisors involved early, and investment banker is typically one of those that you'd want involved early, talk about the benefits of using an outside party in these processes. Why would you get an investment banker involved at all, and why early?
Sure. I mean, I'll talk about a couple of pieces of that. You know, we can talk about the investment banker. We can also talk about the accounting firm. I'm not going to touch on the law or the legal piece, thinking most of our clients or most of the institutions don't have, you know, general counsels on staff. But if we think about it, one, from the accounting firm, we had made the comment that our client is doing their day job. They're running their bank. They are performing management functions for that bank. So they don't have time necessarily. So as it relates to maybe it's diligence, maybe it's something like that, it's a matter of timing and things like that. From an investment banking standpoint, in many cases, that investment banker will be worth many times what that fee is. Now that fee, you know, can make you a little uncomfortable because oftentimes it has a number of zeros after it. But in many cases, that investment banker will uncover a potential buyer, a unique buyer, a strategic buyer that wasn't perhaps on your list. I remember one project that we worked on that we found a unique strategic buyer that wasn't on anyone's list, and they became the high bidder, if you will, to a large extent. And so that process in that case was worth several times what the cost of that project cost our client.
So Kevin, I think your comment about finding a strategic buyer is important, but I'd like to add that sometimes using an investment banker to get into a competitive scenario can help as well. I was working with a client a few years ago that wanted to sell and had actually approached a couple of friendly institutions to see what their interest was. They actually struck a preliminary deal with one of them. After some negotiation, the agreement with their first choice fell through due to some structural issues. They wanted to go right on to the next one on their list, but I was able to talk them into using investment banking services. I was confident there was a buyer out there who would pay up for the opportunity to buy them, but they really needed to get into a competitive process to have that happen. We were able to convince them to use our investment banking arm to help. And at the end of the day, we found a buyer who paid about 40% more than any of the other previous offers. And I might add that the other components, such as culture and so on, were a fit as well. As you said before, the fee for this transaction was pretty large, but after the fees, the shareholders were still millions of dollars ahead. So investment bankers can also be worth their weight in gold. So last question, Kevin, would you recommend bringing in an advisor for a preparatory review even before a sale or before a buyer approaches you?
I think it could make sense as long as they're being objective. That party should not be saying, you need to sell now, you can't wait. You know, if you have a good partner that is objective, you can weigh why you should, why you shouldn't, why you should wait. Maybe your best plan going forward is to become an acquirer. Maybe it's to go it alone. So if you can find that objective party and go through that preparatory like you're talking about, Mike, I think that's the best situation.
Good. Well, Kevin, I think we've had a good discussion today on M&A and valuation. Any last minute key takeaways that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
We're in a unique time right now. You know, 6 months ago, I probably would have answered the question differently than I'm going to answer it right now, Mike. But unique times, there are opportunities. These opportunities perhaps are not without risk. All things being the same, the riskier something is, the less it's worth. Now, we've got the theoretical world of valuation. We've got the practical world of transaction. If you're an acquirer right now, make sure you look at things very, very carefully, given the pandemic that's going on. If you are contemplating a sale, it might make sense. It might not make sense. So I think the bottom line is we're in a unique time period right now. And I think you have to look at things a number of different ways.
Well, that'll wrap up our conversation for today. Hopefully we were able to give you some helpful information on the roles of boards and management, as well as general information related to M&A and related valuation areas. I'd like to thank you, Kevin, for taking the time to give us some perspectives on this topic. We'd also like to remind you to visit the wifley.com website for our COVID-19 Resource Center, as well as lots of other great information and current topics of interest. Until next time, this has been a Bank on Wifley podcast.
You've been listening to Bank on Wifley. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and tune into the next episode as we feature insights from other leaders in the financial industry and even more ways you can stay ahead of the curve.